Good evening, it's 6:30. There's an old chestnut about how to get to Carnegie Hall, but for an Elizabethtown car salesman, making it to the Metropolitan Opera stage is no joke. He's done it, and this is why. We'll find out how he made his dream happen today on Front Page PM from WKMS News. I'm Todd Hatton, in for Chad Lampe, and this is Front Page PM, our Friday evening news magazine, bringing you the stories, events, and issues of our Four Rivers region. We also bring you Front Page AM, Friday mornings at 8:35, and the hour-long Front Page Sunday at 9 a.m. This week, Kentucky's legislature did something it hasn't done in quite some time, that's agreeing to a state budget without the need of a special session. Kentucky Public Radio Capital Bureau Chief Kenny Colston speaks with Rick Howlett about what else happened this past week in Frankfort.
It looked like when we last talked a week ago, it was going to be fairly smooth sailing for the budget this year. And then suddenly there was talk about lawmakers going home without one and even the possibility of the governor having to call a special session. What were the sticking points?
The sticking points were for the House, it was over school construction. And it wasn't even for the next 2 years. It was actually for planning for 2014 through 2016. The House argues that these are, you know, they've been doing this basically pretty regularly since 1985, putting in bonds for future projects. It allows for schools to look ahead and see, you know, plan for and design for, you know, expansions or renovations a few years ahead. And obviously the Senate's big proposal was bonded debt. They wanted less debt, less bonded debt, less structural imbalance. So that was a sticking point. The Senate eventually gave in. There were some other small things, how to fund Rupp Arena expansion, renovations, the horse park. The Senate wanted less debt, less spending. And there's always a lot of posturing when you get to the end of a budget. And this year was no different, except for last year, in past years, except for when the clock started really ticking, they actually came to the table and got something done.
So Governor Beshear proposed an austere budget at the beginning of the session, and that's pretty much what lawmakers are poised to approve.
Well, actually, lawmakers trimmed it down even more. Yeah. So the governor said that he had an inadequate budget to fund the needs of Kentuckians, and lawmakers put in even less money in. So I would hate to think what he would refer to this budget as, but basically it was a tight budget, and there's no way around that.
Is there any threat of a veto?
Well, I'm sure the governor will line item veto some items. He always does. But what's happening is of course, that conference committee compromise that we're talking about now, it has finally landed on lawmakers' desk. They are breaking and looking over the plan now before they vote on it. And with them voting on it, it allows them to come back 2 weeks from now and override any of the governor's vetoes, if he vetoes anything. But I would think he always usually has one line or two. And since he can go one by one, he could, you know, cross out an A, dot a T, or, you know, cross a T, dot an I.
Right.
He can really do whatever. So they're preserving their veto power. And I'm sure that veto will be used, and the lawmakers will talk about overriding them.
Lawmakers go home, and there's a veto period?
That's right. It's about a week and a half. They're planning to return on April 12th. Of course, the governor gets so many days to veto a bill, or it becomes law. And so basically, they give themselves plenty of time for the governor to veto bills. The clock does not officially start until Monday. So they give the governor plenty of time, then they come back, look at what he's vetoed, and decide whether or not they're going to override it or not. Basically, it's a nice little week-and-a-half break. Lawmakers will be back up here either the 12th or the 13th, and they'll look at the bills and say, either we don't care or, yeah, we want to override this.
Are there any other big issues still on the table at this late date?
Well, there actually are. You've got the prescription pill bill, which is House Bill 4. Actually, they had a conference committee, which is closed. They could not agree, so now they're in basically free conference committee, which that means they can throw anything in there at that point. But that's probably likely to go to the veto day. The road plan is still delayed. That's going to go to the veto day. Or they won't have one at all, House Speaker said. That would be disastrous. You're talking about not having funding for the Louisville Bridges Project, for widening I-65. That could be disastrous. But lawmakers are pretty confident they'll get to the veto day and have an agreement. So there are those are the two big issues. Other than that, you've got a lot of issues that are getting sent to the governor's desk. Lawmakers are agreeing or disagreeing, and you know the leaders have to sign bills for them to go to the governor's desk. So we're still looking at that pseudofedrin issue. It has not been signed by legislative leaders, so technically it is not at the governor's desk yet. And then, of course, the dropout bill.
Now, I'm still hearing commercials in support of calling your lawmaker in support of charter schools, but that's pretty much off the table for this session, right?
Yeah. Chairman Rawlins, basically, the Senate amended one of House Education Chairman Carl Rawlins' bill that dealt with districts of innovation, which is what he called charter-like program. They tacked charter schools on the end of that bill. That really upset the chairman, and he called that issue, both of those issues, his and charter schools, dead. And there really hasn't been any movement in the House to talk about, you know, taking up his bill again. So I believe charter schools are probably done, but they've made enough progress that they'll probably have a strong argument next legislative session.
Speaking of next session, one of the big disappointments for Governor Beshear this session was, of course, the his casino gambling amendment failed. Do you think there's going to be any effort to revive it next time around?
You know, that's the chief initiative of the governor. So I have to think before he leaves office, we're going to continue to hear about and see this issue, what that issue looks like, whether it's, you know, statute or constitutional amendment. I don't really know. There's not a lot of talk about that right now. A lot of the focus is on the budget and the road plan. But I would have to think the governor will continue to try to find a way to get expanded gambling in Kentucky until he leaves office.
And I apologize if you mentioned this and I was distracted, but there was a tax amnesty bill was being considered. Is it still up for consideration?
Yeah, there's a compromise on that. Lawmakers are going to push that through. Not a whole lot of changes, a reduction from what the governor wanted in terms of, I guess, scope and people who are going to work on it. But at the same time, that will get done.
Now, this was not complete. Is this complete amnesty, or is this something where you just work out something with the state on paying back taxes?
Yeah, I think you have to pay a portion of your back taxes. And then once you agree to the amnesty, you have to pay your taxes, I think, for 3 to 5 years in a row. You can't be late again, otherwise they'll come back for the full thing. But it allows for people to only pay a portion of their taxes and get the rest forgiven. You really see people who haven't like paid their taxes or corporations who haven't paid their taxes for 5, 8, 10 years. 10 years is the limit. But they're going kind of for the big dogs in this program.
They've had these in the past and collected a fair amount of money.
Yeah, and in this budget, they expect to collect $19 million, which isn't, I mean, in a $19 billion budget,
yeah,
doesn't seem like a lot of money, but $19 million is a pretty good chunk of change when you're talking about, I mean, it's not Mega Millions cash, but, you know, it'll help the budget a little bit.
That's right, every little bit helps. Well, Kenny Colston covers the Kentucky General Assembly and issues in Frankfort for Kentucky Public Radio. Kenny, thanks for joining us. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, you too.
You hear Kenny's reports daily during WKMS newscasts, and you can find his online stories at WKMS.org. Nearly 90% of the corn in this country is genetically modified. And as using genetically modified, or GM corn, becomes increasingly popular in everyday foods, more people are becoming concerned about potential ill effects on human health and the environment. As Kentucky Public Radio's Erica Peterson reports, besides being used in food, that corn is also finding its way into Kentucky's signature spirit, bourbon.
I'm just going to heat this up.
In the grain room at the Four Roses Distillery, master distiller Jim Rutledge is microwaving corn kernels. He takes the glass out, shakes it, and buries his nose in the scent.
Got a very sweet, very clean aromas. If there's anything off, anything different than this, no matter how slight, and if it's anything off at all, we will reject the load.
Tainted corn means tainted bourbon, so it's important to make sure each batch is good. Rutledge's corn looks like any other corn, but it's different from the corn that goes into nearly every other Kentucky bourbon. It's not genetically modified. Last year, 88% of all corn grown in the United States was genetically modified, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. This means it's getting harder for companies to find non-GM corn. Rutledge says Four Roses is only able to keep getting it because the company is willing to pay a premium for its corn. And the farm group they've been using for 52 years is still GMO-free.
You know, they're giving it to us right now how long it can last, because if you start out in the Midwest, just about all the crops that are grown use GMO materials. And as it spreads wider and wider and wider across the U.S., it will eventually become virtually impossible to have really GMO-free corn.
The shortage has already forced larger companies like Brown-Forman to change strategies. Spokesman Phil Lynch says the company decided to use only non-GM corn for its Jack Daniel's whiskey in 2000, based on consumer perceptions. But a decade later, that wasn't an option.
Ultimately, it just became impossible to source enough non-GM corn in order to make enough whiskey.
There are a few reasons for that. More and more farmers are choosing to plant GM seeds because they yield hardier crops that require fewer pesticides. And those genetically modified crops often contaminate other fields through cross-pollination, which means that some farmers are finding keeping their crops GMO-free is beyond their control. So, should you care if you're drinking genetically modified corn in your bourbon? The jury's still out. Chances are, you're already consuming a lot of GMOs in products like soda and canola oil. Doug Gurian-Sherman is a scientist with the Union of Concerned Scientists. He says there's no conclusive evidence that the GMO products on the market today are dangerous to human health, but
there could be many different types of genetically engineered genes from many different sources put into our crops in coming years. And with an inadequate regulatory system, we don't feel that we can be as confident as we should that those crops are going to be safe.
The United States doesn't have a labeling requirement, though most other developed nations do. And Gurian-Sherman says the government is placing too much of the onus on companies to ensure their product is safe for human health. The bourbon companies say using GM corn in their products isn't a concern because there's no genetically modified material left in the bourbon after distillation. Several manufacturers cited scientific studies they say confirm this, but the Kentucky Distillers Association wasn't able to produce the research and wouldn't return further calls for comment. And even companies like Four Roses that could market their products as GMO-free don't. Four Roses' Jim Rutledge.
Well, no, we don't market. We don't advertise.
Rutledge figures someday he won't be able to find GM-free corn to use in his bourbon. But when that day comes, Four Roses will still have at least 6 years of non-genetically modified bourbon aging in barrels. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Erica Peterson.
When we come back, we'll find out if physical activity is a boon or a boondoggle in the fight against childhood obesity, and meet a Kentucky car salesman who's making a name for himself on the opera stage. You're listening to Front Page PM from WKMS News. You're listening to Front Page PM. I'm Todd Hatton. The University of Louisville, University of Kentucky rivalry will reach new heights tomorrow night when the Cats and the Cards clash in the NCAA Final Four in New Orleans. Kentucky Public Radio's Rick Hallett discovers that some are calling it the biggest sporting event in the Commonwealth's history.
This has the feel of a Kentucky Derby week, with the national media lens on Louisville and Lexington focused not on thoroughbreds, but on what makes this basketball rivalry so intense. Rick Pitino is in the unique position of having coached both teams, first 8 years at Kentucky and now 11 seasons in Louisville. This week he explained the fan demographics to an out-of-town questioner.
We're sort of limited to our city. They have as many fans in our city, and it ends up with a lot of bad marriages, a lot of mixed marriages that end up bad. You know, you have a Louisville woman with a Kentucky man, and it always ends bad.
Both programs have well-established traditions, but Louisville is relatively new as a national power, coming to prominence with two titles during the Denny Crum era. Fans say U of L deserves more respect than it often gets from the UK faithful. Kentucky won the first of its seven titles in 1948, and Wildcat basketball has become a religion in many corners of the Commonwealth. UK fans have high expectations, including regular victories over Louisville. Just ask third-year coach John Calipari.
And I love our fans. They're crazy. They watch the game tapes three times. I don't watch the game tapes three times. But that's coaching and playing at Kentucky.
is everyone passionate about college basketball in this area? No question. But it seems like the ones that get through on the internet and or on our shows are the crazy ones.
Tony Vannetti is co-host of the Afternoon Underdogs program on WKRD Radio in Louisville. He and partner Dave Jennings have been fielding lots of calls from fans on both sides this week. They've generally been respectful and often humorous.
My daughter come in my house wearing a blue shirt with Kentucky on it, and I looked out and asked her, "What's that you got on?" She told me, "Said that's a Kentucky shirt." I said, "Well, you can turn around and go on back outdoor." and she took and pulled the shirt up. She said, "See, I got on a red shirt, a Louisville shirt." She was just joking with me.
The UK-UofL Final Four matchup has spurred more talk about the rivalry between coaches Calipari and Patino, who exchanged barbs in the media early in the season. But both told ESPN Radio this week that's all been overblown and there's no personal animosity. Here's Calipari, then Patino.
I've known him for a long time. He's known me for a long time. I really respect him and what he does. And everybody's made more of it than it is.
There really is nothing to it, to be honest with you. We've never had negative words with each other. We've never had a problem. So the media just likes to hop on it.
They play every year now, but this is the first NCAA tournament showdown between Kentucky and Louisville in nearly 30 years. UofL won their 1983 Mideast Region Final matchup. The following year, UK was the winner in a Sweet 16 game.
Welcome to the Joby and Denny Show on Sports Radio 790.
Those Cats and Cards teams were coached by Joby Hall and Denny Crum, who now have their own radio show on WKRD. Louisville was the favorite in that 83 game and won by 12 points in overtime. This time, the Cards are the underdogs, but Crum says that's not necessarily a bad place to be.
It's hard to say that even though one team is the favorite, it's a lock going in. I mean, that's sometimes the kiss of death for you.
Joe Hall believes the Wildcats are on their way to a national title, but both programs will benefit from their time in the national spotlight.
There's not enough you can say about what this game means, not only to the fans and the coaches, but to the future of the programs, the recruiting. It's just a very, very big game.
The Cards and Cats will tip off shortly after 6 p.m. Eastern Time Saturday in New Orleans. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Rick Howlett in Louisville.
The average adult American is ballooning in weight. This isn't breaking news. According to the United States Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Kentucky possessed a 31% obesity rate in 2010, one of the highest in the nation. Naturally, kids are following suit. The nation needs a diet. However, when families strategize ways in which to fight the obesity epidemic, is more activity a key or a curse? Casey Northcott reports.
On a Saturday morning in the Paducah Recreation Center, four children wiggle through a dance routine. Certified Zumbatomics instructor Eve Cotter takes the popular dance exercise Zumba and simplifies it for ages 4 through 12. Cotter says the class gets kids burning calories while enjoying pure, simple motion.
It's fun. It's not like the formatted aerobics classes. That's why if you look at anything Zumba, it says join the party, because it's just fun. You get up and dance, and they build confidence and, you know, yell at the top of their lungs, and it's beautiful.
Programs like Zumbatomics, as well as intramural sports, coax children away from the glow of their gaming systems. In today's society, this activity is vital. According to the National Conference of State Legislatures, Kentucky had a 37% child obesity rate in 2007. That's a 17.5% increase from 2003. Children need more sunshine, grass, dirt, and sweat. They need more activity. But while organized sports programs, dance rehearsals, and martial arts classes can boost the health of children, their parents can suffer as a consequence. Registered dietitian Sherry Ford.
While the kids are doing a good thing, playing sports or involved in something that's, you know, maybe academic team or drama or basketball, they may not be good for the overall family because the family's focus now becomes the kids and they just eat on the run, trying to fit the kids' schedule into their hectic lifestyle.
And grabbing a Big Mac and fries from McDonald's 2 to 3 times per week can take a toll. Ford says when people eat in restaurants, they consume an average of 30% more calories than when they eat at home. The United States Department of Agriculture supports this statement. The department published a study in 2002 saying food prepared away from home contains more calories, total fat, and saturated fat, while containing less dietary fiber, calcium, and iron on a per-calorie basis.
Even if you choose something healthy, like Subway, you're going to make a healthy choice. Your sandwich is going to be, you know, maybe 100 more calories than a sandwich from home just because it's a bigger portion, it's more bread. You're just going to eat more calories.
Standing in the midst of several concession stands in the University of Kentucky's Rupp Arena, a slim Susie Colburn agrees. Her 17-year-old daughter, Sydney, has cheered the Marshall County Marshals all the way to the state tournament. After years of gymnastics lessons and cheerleading, Colburn admits healthy eating doesn't always fit into the family schedule.
A lot of times, let's say, we try to do salads when we go through drive-throughs and things like that. But then when it's cold, I end up eating cheeseburgers and french fries because it's more comfort food.
From the stands, Michelle Clark watches her son Chase play ball against Scott County. In the past, when Chase and his older brother both played Marshall County basketball, the Clark family attended events 4 to 5 times per week. Clark says she and her husband tried to eat grilled chicken and salads, but burgers also got thrown into their menus. This didn't help their health.
Did you notice any negative effects on your health during the sports season?
I gained a lot of weight. A lot of weight. My husband did too, though.
These problems persist throughout the country as more and more people eat out. According to the USDA, Americans spent about 50% of their food budget in 2004 on meals prepared outside the home. That's up roughly 16% from survey results in 1974. So what should people do? Children obviously need activity. Sherry Ford, a veteran basketball and cross-country mom herself, says the answer lies in planning.
As much as you can around your busy schedule, eat at home. Make a pot of soup in the morning and put it in the crock pot. Put a roast in the morning. There's going to be things that you can do if you plan ahead.
The dietitian says when eating at home won't work, take a sandwich and a cup of yogurt to the game. Looking ridiculous is better than looking unhealthy. With some forethought, the entire family can stay fit. It just takes a will and a crock pot. For WKMS News, I'm Casey Northcutt.
Many Kentuckians are focused like a laser on March Madness, but last weekend, while UK and U of L were advancing to the Final Four, another major national competition took place in New York City, where a Kentucky car salesman made a name for himself in the highly selective opera scene. Anthony Clark Evans is one of 5 2012 National Council audition winners. Rebecca Feldhaus has more.
Thanks for coming back. I mean, I would have never got to sell your car if you hadn't come back.
Anthony Clark Evans is back at work at an Elizabethtown car lot talking about in-car sound systems and legroom to sell a Toyota Camry to Mary and James McCubbins.
Well, we'd rather get one in E-Town anyway.
Because it's closer. Yeah. Because I'm better sales, I'm better looking.
But earlier this month, the 27-year-old Owensboro native was performing his dream job on stage at the Metropolitan Opera. After battling his way through regional opera competitions over 2.5 months, Evans claimed the Metropolitan Opera National Council Audition's Grand Winner Prize. Other winners of the award include greats like Renee Fleming, Thomas Hampson, and Jesse Norman. In short, Evans had his time on one of the best-known and respected opera stages in the world, and now he is still in post-award shock.
Last week, I was sitting at my desk in the dealership, not even thinking about music whatsoever. And this guy was telling me why my car was terrible, but he still wanted to pay, you know, nothing for it. And I'm just like, where am I right now? I mean, it was totally surreal.
To answer Evans's question, he's in the driver's seat. He is the winner of one of the most prestigious opera competitions in the world, and he did it without a college degree. He studied voice at Murray State University for a few years. He got married and needed to support himself. So he moved to Elizabethtown, Kentucky, and got a job at Swope Toyota. Evans didn't just show up at the Met and enter the contest. He decided to enter district competition mere days before the deadline. He paid for a few extra vocal coaching sessions and went to Memphis. Then he just kept going. A win at the National Council auditions has launched careers of numerous opera superstars, but there's no guarantee. Editor-in-chief of Opera News magazine, F. Paul Driscoll, puts it into perspective.
This is, make no mistake about it, the big time, but it is usually a prelude to the next step professionally.
Evans has made a heroic ascent in the past few months. His arias were solid. He rarely gets nervous, and it showed in his final concert performance.
In my opinion, if someone who comes from a background like his is still able to summon up the nerve to give a solid performance on all these various audition rounds, then he has an excellent chance of being able to keep his head on straight as he embarks on a professional career.
Dr. Randall Black was Evans' voice teacher during his time at Murray State. Black is enthusiastic about his chances at making it, but the work ahead will be a challenging test to his dedication.
It's exciting right now, but just as anything that is work, it will become less exciting with time. And it's when you get in the trenches and have to do that daily drudgery that the will to succeed, the will to do something special really has to come to the forefront.
Black hopes for Evans to find what he calls an angel. Angels are those philanthropists who love the arts so much they want to ensure new talent like Evans have access to resources they need. A successful opera career combines talent, hard work, a strong support base, and yes, some luck. It's going to take some luck, Evans says, to continue garnering attention at such a high level. Without regular singing gigs or a degree under his belt, Evans doesn't look that great on paper.
When they look at my resume, it's not going to say much. Da-da-da-da-da, nothing, met. And then what I'm trying to avoid right now is da-da-da-da-da, nothing, met, nothing. Because I think that may end up happening if I don't really keep my eyes on the ball right now.
Evans keeps no illusions about what's ahead. There are some singers who dropped off the map for years or even decades before making their professional Metropolitan Opera debut. Some burst on the scene and never left.
Is it going to be that, or is it going to be the other way where I have to train for so long and then I finally make my glorious debut? Or is it going to be like a celebrated long career? To tell you the truth, I don't care, because at this point, it's going to happen.
One way or another, Evan says, he'll be singing opera for the rest of his life. For WKMS News, I'm Rebecca Feldhaus.
This has been Front Page PM, our new regional news segment following Marketplace at 6:30 on Fridays. You may have missed Front Page AM today, now a regular feature at 8:35 Friday mornings. So if you'd like to hear these or any of our stories again, you can find them online anytime at WKMS.org. You can also catch us this Sunday morning at 9 for our hour-long program, Front Page Sunday. I'm Todd Hatton. Thanks for listening.